Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio, and it is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 8th Monday. We are celebrating International Women's Day 2021 on KBOO and the Old Mole. International Women's Day has occurred for well over a century, with the first gathering held in 1911. And we have a really great show for you this morning that starts with Bill Resnick talking with Susanna Kasouf, a climate justice leader and activist with the Portland Sunrise Movement. The Sunrise Movement is rapidly growing across the U.S. and around the world and attracting lots of young people. Susanna and Bill examine the how and why of women's, particularly BIPOC women's, increasing participation and power in climate action and climate justice movements and struggles. They'll discuss also the priorities for climate action in Portland and Oregon at large. Jan Hawken talks with Extinction Rebellion PDX organizer Diana Meisenhalter about the national mobilization to support the Indigenous-led Stop Line 3 actions in northern Minnesota and why these actions are so critical in the fight against expansion of fossil fuel pipelines. We'll have more information on upcoming actions at the end of the program, but you'll hear about those as well during this segment. In the second half of today's program, Johanna Brenner interviews Adam Obenauer, organizing director of the Retail Warehouse and Department Store Union. They discuss the campaign to organize Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama. It's a predominantly African-American city with a proud history of union and social justice organizing. And we conclude the Old Mole with Desiree Helliger's talking with Lana Jack, Celilo YM activist organizer and director of the Columbia River Indian Center. They talk about the upcoming March 10th anniversary of the inundation of Celilo Falls and about the links between colonialism, patriarchy, the exploitation of indigenous lands, and violence against indigenous women. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Susanna Kasouf.
Hello, Susanna Kasouf. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Susanna Kasouf is one of the activists, often a spokesperson in Portland Sunrise Movement. It's rapidly grown, attracting young people. In fact, last year organized a congressional day when they challenged the Congress to act on climate change. It culminated in a sit-in that drew a lot of national attention. As to Portland, Sunrise strongly supports the radical Sanders Ocasio vision of the Green New Deal and has worked with many other Portland groups, including 350.org and the group Extinction Rebellion, the Sierra Club, the Just Transition Alliance that recently formed the Oregon Clean Energy Alliance, and many other organizations. They together won some important victories in the city, stopping fossil fuel exports and winning a ballot initiative to create a Portland Clean Energy Fund. So, Susanna Kasouf, today it's International Women's Day. Women hold up half the sky and are a majority of the staff and activists in Portland's climate action and climate justice groups and their struggles. That's true across the country, also across the world. How do you understand that? How is it that women have become so important in the staff and leadership?
Well, I think that women are socialized in many cultures to be caregivers and to promote harmony and a sense of others over self almost too much sometimes. I think the core of a movement that is successful is a feeling of harmony and love within the group, a feeling of we can do this together. We have power with one another. It's not that one of us in the group is more powerful than another person in the group, but the needs of the group actually come before the needs of the individual, and we work together towards our goal. And so last year I was a student teacher at Lincoln High School, and I was a student teacher in the environmental justice class, and it was mostly young women, although we had some good boys in there too. But I think that way that we're socialized to be caring really extends to the way that we view our world and care about our world. I actually just taught a lesson today about how the dominant culture has this view of nature that it's like subordinate to humans, that we have power over it. But like indigenous cultures have this view of nature, of humans as the younger siblings of creation, and of plants and animals as sovereign beings that deserve respect. And I think women, because of the way we're socialized, really it's easier for us to tap into that way of seeing the world and to caring for the world around us.
In the literature, Susanna, what's called the developing world, that literature points out that women are most impacted by and knowledgeable about environmental devastation, and that they, particularly BIPOC women, experience firsthand caring for the young, the old, the vulnerable, who are also most affected by climate change. Have you looked at those issues?
Yeah, well, not only are women most affected by climate change, because so often around the world we see women being at the forefront of agriculture when it comes to like indigenous agriculture or rural agriculture, and like you said, women at the forefront of caregiving, but also women really have the most to gain from the concept of a Green New Deal. Because what's really exciting to me about a Green New Deal is that it's not just about lowering carbon emissions, it's about reimagining our economy so that we are actually valuing the already low carbon work of caregiving. And rather than having our lives center around acquiring more things that is just crap that we're going to throw away, you know, it's focused instead around caring for one another, caring for each other, the arts, et cetera, all these places where women, again, because of our socialization, are already shining and being completely undervalued for their work. So the idea of a Green New Deal is that home health aides, teachers, doctors, nurses, they start to be really valued for that valuable work of caregiving, monetarily and otherwise in society.
Yeah, it means decent jobs for all, where people are respected and work together. And particularly, of course, in caregiving, it's often the community and the peers and people working together to self-organize and develop some community power and give one another support.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, BIPOC women are the most affected by climate change all over the world. Like we think about 9 out of 10 African farmers not being able to grow food by the year 2050, or like entire island nations in the Maldives or the Philippines just completely disappearing underwater. But again, it's BIPOC women who are often relegated to these caregiving roles in society, are marginalized to roles where so many white people, if you are wealthy, grew up in a home where you might have had a nanny who was a person of color. For so many BIPOC women, for so long, that was almost the only avenue towards work. And so again, when you shift the economy to be those being the jobs that are actually front and center and deserve the most respect and then also like resources, then you really start to heal the wounds that need to be healed in order for us to actually tackle this climate crisis. Naomi Klein, who I love, is a really brilliant journalist and writer. She talks about needing to enter a new phase of our economy where we focus on care and repair. We center the care economy and then also repair. So not only learning to repair our things, which we need to, we can't keep having this culture of disposability with our stuff, but also learning to repair our relationships and repairing generations of harm that have been done, and learning that there are no disposable people either, that we all have a place in this world together.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Susanna Kapoof. She's an activist, sometimes a spokesperson in the very youthful Sunrise Movement in Portland. We've been discussing why women have become central to the groups and movements around the world. Here, too, in Portland, struggling to reconstruct the world's economy and popular ways of life, that could deal with the major issue facing humanity today, surviving climate change. And again, building that better, sustainable, democratic world. Susanna, you discussed that women operate horizontally. They're not comfortable in top-down positions ruling others. The women's traditional role, which has to become the role of all of us, including resistant males, and some are moving. There's movement around the world. It's quite interesting, slow to be sure, and furiously resistant. But still, if we're going to have a habitable planet, seems to me we have to begin living in very different ways, respecting everybody, giving people a place at the table, which is what they really want. They want to live in dignity, which is not what most people, in fact, are aspiring to. They're aspiring to being respected and being respected members of a decent community. My sense is that women are now becoming so much more prominent in leadership, even in major hierarchical corporations, unfortunately or unfortunately, because they have a much greater capacity for building that community and providing respect and democratic contributory positions so people feel good about their lives.
Well, okay. First, I feel like I should clarify that I don't think women just, or maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think women inherently feel uncomfortable in these top-down positions. I think that women are socialized to feel uncomfortable in them. But I think that there definitely are some women who do feel comfortable in them. And like you just mentioned, women are the head of our corporations right now. And I would imagine that many of the women who are heads of corporations right now do feel very comfortable in that kind of top-down power. But the reason, like we said before, that I think so many social movements attract women is because we are socialized into that desire for care, right? To care for those around us, which is really what social justice is about. My favorite intellectual writer thinker of our time is Cornel West. And he says, justice is what love looks like in public. And I really agree with that. And again, we're socialized, we as women are socialized to value love and to center love. And I think that's a beautiful thing about being a woman. And it's something I wish for everyone in our society, because when you center your life around love, you have a deep, rich, and fulfilling life because you prioritize your relationships, you prioritize your world. And when you start to do that, then you start to realize exactly what you said, that every human being on this earth deserves dignity, deserves to live a dignified life. And going back to Naomi Klein again, she says that we have the resources for every person on this earth to have public luxury and private sufficiency. So we don't have the resources for everyone to have private luxury, but honestly, that's not what makes us happy anyway. I believe we need to have some aspect of our private lives, you know, that are ours. We can come home. We have a safe place to go, a place with our family. But our lives are more full, are more exciting, are more loving, are more fulfilling when we live in community. So when we have communities that are strong, everyone has health care. Everyone has access to a good job. We have thriving arts and theater programs and beautiful fields where we can play sports, and everyone has access to as much education as they want. You can get as many master's degrees as you want. This is the kind of world that we can build, and this is the kind of world that is going to make us happier anyway. So I often say and think that as scary and overwhelming and depressing as the climate crisis is, and I wish that it wasn't, but it's also giving us an opportunity, because the way that we're living right now is just not working for most people. A lot of people today don't even feel that they have one person in their life that they can confide in and really tell their feelings to. And that's just no way to live. We need to reimagine the way we're living together. And this is our opportunity to do that.
Susanna Kassouf, thanks a lot for talking to us today. Keep up the good work and Sunrise. Let's win some elements of that community that you're talking about in Portland over the next several years. Certainly reconstructing everything to be able to meet the challenge of fulminating climate roasting. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Susanna Kassouf.
Okay, thank you.
I gave you all I had to give. My love, my time, I couldn't give the life I lived. That can't be right, I never thought that they could be for you and me. The scenes of fate I couldn't see, the song I'd never see.
Next up on The Old Mole, Jan Hocken talks with Extinction Rebellion PDX organizer Diana Meisenhalter about the national mobilization to support the Indigenous-led Stop Line 3 actions in northern Minnesota. Jan?
Welcome to KABU, Diana Meisenhalter.
Hi.
When this report airs on Monday, March 8th, you will likely be in Minnesota along with other activists joining the camps there to stop Line 3. This proposed pipeline expansion would carry close to 1 million barrels a day of the highly toxic tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, through untouched wetlands and the treaty territory of Anishinaabe peoples, and an area that includes the Mississippi River headwaters and other critical waterways. This expanded pipeline would be the carbon equivalent of 50 new coal-fired plants. Over the years, Indigenous-led resistance to Line 3 has been successful in throwing hurdles in the path of this lethal project. So what has happened recently, Diana, that makes mobilization now so critical?
Well, since December, over 100 water protectors have been arrested in resistance to this horrific project. And we are answering the call of Indigenous water protectors who are now calling nationally for folks to show up on the front lines. Today's International Women's Day, and this movement is being led by courageous Indigenous women like Tara Hauska, Tasha Martineau, and many others. With thousands of out-of-state workers, the man camps have been proven to be a real threat to Indigenous women, as well as a huge COVID hazard for all. But most importantly, at the end of March, Enbridge is going to be renewing $2.2 billion in loans. They have to seek renewals from 18 banks, and we want to stop that money pipeline. Plus, given the momentum from the KXL cancellation, we need to push the Biden administration to cancel Line 3 and DAPL as well by putting pressure on Gina McCarthy, the White House's new climate policy advisor. Enbridge is trying to push this all through by June. And one of the critical things they're trying right now to do is that this pipeline will cross over 227 bodies of water, and Indigenous folks want to stop it before that happens. And these women are protecting not only their lands and waters, but the seven generations to follow. Extinction Rebellion and other activists are headed to Minnesota from around the country for a week of action March 8th through the 14th. At the same time, we're encouraging folks around the country to do daily online actions available at Stop the Money Pipeline or Stop Line 3. And we're going to provide a website on KABU that has a step-to-step on how to either join us in Minnesota or the online solidarity actions you can do here in Portland. In addition, there's going to be socially distanced actions targeting banks deciding on the loan renewals, such as Chase or Bank of America, right here in Portland. Extinction Rebellion and Stop the Money Pipeline are coming together to act, and you can find details by emailing us or going to our Twitter site, and we'll provide that online as well.
So there are many ways people can support the mobilization there, in addition to being part of the car caravans from around the country. There are local things people can do, and we'll be posting that. As you mentioned, March 8th, as people listen to this report today, is International Women's Day, and the climate justice movement includes many groups and organizations, with Indigenous women playing particularly important leadership roles in recent years. So what does it mean for you as a white climate activist to be part of an Indigenous-led mobilization and action, and particularly how we think about maybe the intersection of gender justice, racial justice, and climate justice?
Well, we were trained this last week by Indigenous activist Renee Miller Chacon, and she works with Spirit of the Sun in preparing for this week of action. And she spoke of women as life givers, as fierce protectors for future generations, as warriors of love and compassion. And she asked us, how will you be a good ancestor in the face of predatory capitalism and colonialist policies, where we must all do our power in order to help our siblings, the plants and the animals, survive along with ourselves? And then she went on to distinguish between allies who show solidarity, educate, listen, and make statements speaking the truth, with accomplices who are willing to sacrifice and take action under the leadership of and in solidarity with communities impacted by racism, dismantling oppressive structures and creating alternative ones while working to restore wealth, reparations, and justice. Some have likened it, she said, to a birth process, intense labor, and then that space where one pulls back from the contractions, and there is that first medicine of breath and a regenerative moment to rebuild strength before the intense labor begins yet again. So I would really hope that people take this week to prepare for daily actions, March 8th through the 14th, and then help us draw attention nationwide to this righteous struggle being led by Indigenous women for the safety and benefit of us all. And so please take the time to check out the KBOO website and center yourself on what needs to be done.
This is an important way to both celebrate, honor, and act for International Women's Day. Thanks so much, and we hope to hear further reports from you from the road and the camps.
Will do.
We turn now to Johanna Brenner, talking with Adam Obenauer. He's an organizer with the Retail Warehouse and Department Store Union. They discuss the campaign to organize Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama. Johanna?
Adam Obenauer, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Adam Obenauer is the Retail Organizing Director of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, RWDSU. This is the union that is waging a David versus Goliath battle against Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama. There, the workers are voting on whether or not to join the union. This will be only the second time in Amazon's history that workers have organized to the point of holding an election, and it is the first time that a huge Amazon fulfillment center, like the one in Bessemer, that employs upward of 6,000 workers, has had a union election. Now, it goes against stereotype that this first major challenge to Amazon is taking place in the South. But if you know the history of RWDSU and of Bessemer, Alabama, it explains why this awe-inspiring effort is happening there. So, Adam, tell us a bit about this history.
Thanks for having me. And our union, the RWDSU, has been a mainstay in the South, I mean, predominantly in Alabama, for a long period of time. And back in the time period, the 60s, you know, our union was involved in the civil rights struggle, specifically in Alabama, was part of the Selma March, and was part of a lot of the Poor People's Campaign back then. And so our union has regularly been part of social struggles in the South and in Alabama, and is very familiar with organizing in the area, you know. And I think that while you see some people be surprised by the first Amazon facility that has a real chance here to unionize is in Alabama, we don't really feel that way. We feel like it's been a hotbed for years and years and years of both civil rights organizing, racial justice organizing, right, and labor organizing. And so, you know, when you look at Alabama, it is among one of the higher states that are unionized in the South, for sure. And we think that it makes sense that the workers are outraged and ready to organize in the state.
Tell us a little bit about how this all got started. I understand that it began last summer in the context of the Black Lives Matter uprising, that some workers at the facility came to the union.
Yeah, so workers did come to the union. You know, our union in the South also represents a lot of poultry food processing and manufacturing plants. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, when it really started to hit, we as a union and our members of the union had to fight back against specific things that were not okay, right? The CDC recommendations that were not being followed and social distancing parameters that were not being followed in some of the plants. And so we had a lot of media around that trying to push employers to actually respect the law. We were successful in many ways. And I think the Amazon workers that first came to the union hall, that's kind of how they heard about it, right? They saw that we were in the news. We also have been around for a bit. And so it just made sense. And so Amazon workers came to the union hall and said, hey, how do we get a union? How do we go from non-union to union? And so we started having some meetings with folks. That's where it started. Where we are now is an entirely different place with thousands of workers that have gotten engaged with the whole unionizing effort. But it definitely came from a small handful of workers that wanted to make a change.
It went really fast. So your first step was to get workers to sign cards saying that they were interested in having a union. And you apparently had some help from the poultry workers themselves who came to work with the campaign.
Yeah. What we ended up doing was we had a lot of poultry workers specifically, but also other warehouse workers in Alabama that are members of the union. And we did a training program for our members to do external organizing. You know, these are folks that in Right to Work Alabama are regularly doing union orientations and signing up their coworkers on dues authorization cards because of the nature of Right to Work states. And so they're very familiar with internal organizing and how to build power in their own work sites. And so what we did was we took some of these folks out of the poultry plant for a period of time to talk about their experience and organize the workers. We also believe that that's why we've been successful to the degree that we have, because it's very different for a member who is currently a part of the union, who pays dues to the union, who's excited about the union, and who has helped with grievance processes and helped get workers back to work that have lost their jobs as shop stewards for our union. They're better off explaining that process to workers who don't have a union because they experience it in their day-to-day work life. And this is something that I think unions have done for a long time, but maybe we should do more of, is train our current membership to be invested as well into growing the union, because if we grow the union, we're also more powerful to take on the employers that everyone works at that are represented by the union when it comes contract time. And so that's kind of the theory that we had with this campaign, was to get our membership engaged and involved, because we feel that it's the most appropriate way to unionize. And the hearing from workers themselves is obviously great. And when you can hear that workers that are part of the union actually enjoy paying dues because it makes sense to them, and that dues are not legal in Alabama, which is a big misinformation piece Amazon's been pushing out, they're the best mouthpieces for that.
Yeah, that was really impressive to me. I think that worker self-organization creates powerful union militancy and capacity, clearly. One of the things that I think is important to talk about here is poultry plants are difficult places to work in, and I think people understand that, but Amazon is this kind of high-tech sweatshop. Can you talk a little bit about some of the issues that brought the Amazon workers to you?
Sure. The idea that $15 an hour is enough for every worker that does backbreaking work at a fulfillment center like one of these is very much a myth. I think that some people feel that it is decent, but a lot of workers do not. And when you look at specific minimum wage, you know, the fight for 15 and minimum wage is being pushed up to 15, that also doesn't mean that the richest employer in the world should be paying 15. It doesn't mean that workers shouldn't be getting some form of hazard pay that they were getting for a period of time but was taken away. The pandemic's still happening, and no one necessarily expected the pandemic to happen this long. But the fact that it has, you know, certain employers did project some type of hazard pay and they've taken it away. And so I would say that pay is definitely a motivator for a large portion of workers at the Amazon Fulfillment Center. There's also a lot of stuff that Amazon does to track workers.
Yeah. I've heard about that. It's this thing called the time off task, and where they monitor your every movement.
Yeah, so time off task is really when you step away from your workstation. These are low-lift facilities that have many, many boxes. You basically have repetitive motion. You know, you turn around, you pick up the box, you put it on the belt, you press the button when it's ready to go. once you walk away from your station, you start getting what's called TOT time, like you mentioned. And so some workers are really frustrated by this because their bathroom times are monitored. Obviously, their breaks are monitored. You clock out for your lunch break and you have your 15-minute break. But the point is, overall, they're constantly monitored. So let's just say you're not doing well one day, you're not feeling that well, you go to the bathroom a little bit too much, your numbers are going to be reflective of that, and you're going to have a high TOT time. And that's frustrating, right? That level of stress and anxiety that is created.
Is there a penalty for high TOT time? In other words, are you penalized at some point if you have too much?
Yes, it is definitely an offense that is a write-up. I would say that a lot of workers do get written up for too much TOT time. Also, one of the major issues is this is a very automated facility in the sense that you have an app called A to Z, and you know you have your manager listed on your app, and then you get written up through the app a lot. So workers will just get a write-up directly to their phone with no meeting from management.
Right.
No HR meeting, nothing. You know, you can call HR and ask for a remedy to it, which puts you down this long road of trying to get in touch with someone. Tons of complaints about HR in general, that they just give you the runaround and steer you in different directions. And that's part of the frustration that workers have, too. Not enough paid time off.
Sorry to cut you off. This is one of the reasons that having a union grievance procedure is such an important issue here for workers organizing, right? That they have some just cause system where they just aren't disciplined by a machine, for God's sake.
Right. 100%. I mean, and also there are workers that, for example, you're a woman and you work at this facility, right? And you get pregnant. And we've had multiple workers tell us that they've been written up because they were pregnant and they had too much TOT time. And then they call HR. They can't really get to HR. They get the runaround. They don't get a clear answer. Their write-ups don't get removed. It's a mess. It's just a mess. And that's what we've been telling people. A grievance procedure gives you a seat at the table and levels the playing field for what management currently is doing. We're not a union that is selling anything to the workers. We're just explaining the process and what unionization will do to benefit you. You know, the workers themselves become the union. They are the union, and therefore that's what we're trying to get across to everybody, that democracy at work is the biggest fear that Amazon has, not the union meddling with affairs as some third party that they're trying to paint us as.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how when Amazon got wind of the fact that you were trying to organize workers to sign cards, they had a very big response. Can you talk about some of the things that Amazon did to intimidate the people there?
Yeah, sure. For starters, like you mentioned, a lot of workers got engaged in a very short period of time. And so Amazon flooded what we call flooding the unit. When we were organizing the workers, we had a universe of workers that we had from their public press that they've done and the subsidies that they did, that they got and they received for their work, the workers they were going to hire, which was 1,500. We assumed that the facility was higher than that because we were talking to so many workers, but Amazon then hired 3,000 workers to put into the unit. Part of that is because it's their understanding that newer workers that just get hired are going to have a honeymoon period and are not going to be that agitated. What we witnessed and why we are where we are is that workers were signing up to join the union even on their first week as they were getting hired because they understand unions to be good. I would say that in Birmingham and in Bessemer, there's a very good impression of unions. People historically think unions are positive that live in this community, and there's a good overall sense of what a union can do, and I think that was something Amazon didn't necessarily expect. So what they then did was what you're explaining, which was the pushback. And the pushback is severe. It's extreme. I like to say every employer gets a union busting package when they have a union campaign. And it's called either labor avoidance or labor education packages. And I would say Amazon bought the platinum package, the most expensive one, the one that includes the website, doitwithoutdues.com. It includes the handouts that they've had created that encourage workers to vote against the union and have complete misinformation about the union itself. It is the life-size posters saying, do it without dues, unions can't, we can, all throughout the fulfillment center. It's everything that they're doing, including these mandatory labor classes where they're telling workers why the union is bad, why they just want to steal your money, and you should vote against the union. And so they are doing all of it. Most workers have gone through between 5 and 10 of these classes. The interesting part here is you were just mentioning TOT time. Workers aren't penalized for attending these classes. They're not penalized for that. And all of a sudden, there's just so much time that Amazon has to train workers on their what they're calling labor rights or busting the union. But when it comes down to it, in a regular day for Amazon, they have no time for even a few minutes of you being off your task. So it just shows you how much they're investing in the union busting.
I understood, too, that they put flyers up in the bathroom stalls, and somebody said at eye level above the urinals. I thought that was pretty...
Yeah, it's thorough. It's dystopian in many ways, you know? It's
really,
very much like
really.
A 1984 kind of Orwellian.
Right. Big Brother is watching you everywhere. This was an all-out press by Amazon, but amazingly, you got, I don't know, something like 3,000 people to sign cards.
Yeah.
A quote I read that I thought was really great from the Western Alabama Labor Council president. And he said something like, I can't tell you how many times we heard, my mother told me if I didn't sign this card, she's going to kick my ass. He said, we heard that from uncles, grandparents, cousins. That's the spirit of Bessemer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that
definitely.
Implies that there was a real community base for workers organizing.
Absolutely.
You are listening to KBOO Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Johanna Brenner here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Adam Obernauer, Retail Organizing Director for the Retail Warehouse and Department Store Union, about the epic struggle to win a union election at one of Amazon's gigantic fulfillment centers in Bessemer, Alabama. We were talking about how Amazon pulled out all the stops to prevent warehouse workers from signing cards for the union, but you won and they lost. Now you have to win the election. How are you organizing workers to vote yes?
It's a great question. Thank you. We are organizing with the workers. We have our committee. They're getting their vote out. They're talking to their coworkers to get the vote out to vote for the union. We are maintaining a positive messaging. You know, Amazon's continuing to hammer negativity. They're continuing to tell workers that they've been divided and that the union has divided them. We're looking back to why the workers came to us to unionize in the first place, which is to improve the working conditions at the workplace and also to improve the community. Amazon and Bessemer, it employs 6,000 workers, and Bessemer's not a huge, huge area. And so the amount of workers that would be impacted by better working conditions will actually go back into the local communities, which is part of what workers are talking about, too. I would say that your point that you made earlier, too, on the community, there's a lot of history in Alabama and in Bessemer of union organizing. And people's families, their aunts, their uncles, their parents are a huge component in why they're supporting the union. And I would say that that has a lot to do with both the labor roots and also the racial justice roots and the struggle that people have faced in the community of both Birmingham and Bessemer. This is a unique and resilient group of workers, and they are fighting back in a way that I think is just impressive. And so I would say that we are getting the vote out, and we're trying to maintain our positive messaging. We have a lot of organizations and people that are going to encourage workers to vote for the union. We just had Stacey Abrams on Saturday give a statement and speak to the workers virtually saying that she supports the union and the democratic right to vote for the union, which I think is really powerful. And we're going to continue to do that as Amazon continues their negative tirade and makes workers fearful of even standing up for the union. We're going to try to push through that light with positivity.
One last point. There was a very big struggle over the last few years in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The UAW tried to organize a VW plant there, and they faced incredible opposition. Not so much from the company, but from politicians, from the state legislature. The governor of Tennessee came and talked to them about why they shouldn't join a union and how it would kill the economy of Tennessee. Are you facing that kind of opposition in Bessemer, or politically are you in a better shape there?
Well, I would say that a lot of people keep their distance on criticizing Amazon because of how powerful they are. And I think that is definitely something that we recognize. and we try to be conscious of when we're looking for support. I would also say, though, that there have been specific politicians that have been incredibly helpful. I just mentioned Stacey Abrams. You know, I think that her coming out in favor of the union effort for us is something we expected. But it's also great to see, especially after what we saw happen in Georgia, you know, a few months ago. And so I think that that matters for sure. Your obvious people like a Bernie Sanders have been incredibly helpful. And I think, though, that in the overall scheme of things on a local level, we are continuing to try our best to work with anyone that will work with us on things, especially on Amazon, you know, of course, and the support we can use right now. But I would say that we have faced some barriers in some areas of the political spectrum, for sure.
But not the kind of full-on press that the UAW faced in Tennessee, it sounds like. And maybe that's because of the history of Birmingham in the Birmingham area, both politically and in terms of movements. Let's end with talking about how folks out here can support the Amazon Workers Campaign. I know you have a site where people can send messages of solidarity. And is there anything else we can do?
Well, for starters, I'd say we are likely at some point going to do call-outs for national solidarity. There was, of course, the great events that were put on February 20th, which
we just went up here.
Yeah, I mean, many cities all over, right? It's just so impressive. And we definitely feel this energy also in Alabama, but also around the nation, the awakening that we see. And I would say that how people can help out, check our website at amazonunion.org. We will probably have some updates that regular folks that are not working at Amazon can do to help, and we'll do call-outs when that happens. And again, moving forward, there will probably be a big contract fight here. So this is just the beginning. It's starting in, right outside Birmingham in Bessemer, Alabama, and it's the beginning of what we will probably hope to see as workers resisting the continual treatment that they're facing under a pandemic. We're looking towards that into the future, and we're more than happy to direct folks on things that they can do. As of right now, it would be follow us on social media at Amazon Union, at both Twitter, on Facebook, if you have either of those, and also at our website at amazonunion.org.
Adam Oppenauer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. More than happy to update y'all whenever you want.
That's great. We're rooting for you out here. All the best.
Thanks so much.
We conclude today with Desiree Helgers talking with Lana Jack, Celilo Wyom activist, organizer, and director of the Columbia River Indian Center. They're going to talk about the upcoming March 10th anniversary of the inundation of Celilo Falls, as well as links between colonialism, patriarchy, the exploitation of indigenous lands, and violence against indigenous women. Desiree?
This coming Wednesday, March 10th, marks the 64th anniversary of the inundation of Celilo Falls following the construction of the Dalles Dam. Celilo Falls is recognized as the oldest continuously inhabited site in North America, and for thousands of years it was one of the largest, most vibrant trading sites in the Americas, with people coming from as far away as the Midwest and British Columbia to trade. Up until the inundation of the falls, it was also a tourist magnet that drew people from around Oregon and beyond to watch Columbia River Indians fish from platforms around the falls. Today, I'm talking with Lana Jack, Celilo Wyom activist, organizer, and director of the Columbia River Indian Center. The Celilo Wyom are a matriarchal, matrilineal tribe of non-treaty Indians, and Jack has now been struggling for decades for federal recognition of the Celilo Wyom. In the absence of federal recognition, the Celilo Wyom lack access to health care, and under U.S. law, they have no legal right to fish in the sites where their ancestor did since time immemorial. As a result, Jack's brother and sister have been repeatedly jailed and imprisoned for fishing on a river that the family has fished on since time immemorial. I spoke with Lana on Wednesday and Thursday of this past week about the inundation of the falls and about the links between colonialism, patriarchy, the exploitation of indigenous lands, and violence against indigenous women. On some reservations, indigenous women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average for women. According to a report by the National Crime Information Center, in 2016, there were 5,712 reports of missing American Indian and Alaskan Native women and girls. but only 116 of those cases actually made it into the federal missing persons database. And in the vast majority of the cases, the perpetrators are non-Native men. Nationally, the city with the highest rates of missing and murdered Indigenous women is right here in our own backyard, Seattle, Washington. May 5th is National Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Day, and so on International Women's Day, let's ask ourselves what we plan to do on May 5th in our schools, universities, community colleges, cities, county, and state governments to address this epidemic. And it's important to note that it's not just Native women who go missing. In fact, Michael Murphy, the brother of Nimiipuu Mole Julian Ankeny, is among the missing. Michael Murphy is Nimiipuu and Shoshone Paiute. Before I play excerpts from my conversation with Lana Jack, I'm going to begin with audio that Lana recorded on the Columbia River on Friday by the site of Celilo Falls. Here's Lana Jack.
A drum call to the ancestors. And even as I sit here next to the falls, who is alive and not dead, an eagle answers the call. A fish jumps. The seagulls swarm. In remembering Celilo Falls, I'd like to just take a moment of silence. I am reminded of a time when our people were free here. Free to breathe, free to run, free to live the natural law to its fullest here at Celilo. Those days are gone. I remember my ancestors' words, as we are an oral culture people. I remember their hearts as they spoke. Well, a lot of them didn't speak about it because it was too hard to talk about the day they took Celilo Falls prisoner of war, put her in isolation. The great matriarch, our sacred ancestor, silenced. These are all the things that we as YM share in common with her. Coyote played a trick on us here at Celilo, hiding away in isolation in the falls, in the murky depths of the water that is now a Superfund site, so full of toxins, man-made toxins, that neither one of us is allowed to breathe freely on this earth as our Creator made us to be. We belong to this river. It is our lifeline. In the distance across the river, we can hear a train rumbling by. It is violence to our spirits. Our identity is intrinsic in that we are this river. We are this land. It made us heathens and savages, pagans, for knowing that the voice of all the animals, birds, fish, water, air that were created before us were sovereign on their own by natural law. The sacredness of our way, the sinwitki, our way of life, as a people here in our longhouses. My great-grandmother, Minnie Wesley Showway, my grandmother, Irene Williams Bruno, were the head woman here when they came to annihilate us, to displace us, to relegate us, to disenfranchise us as the inherent sovereignty, as the voice of the said territory. Even as we are defined in so many marginalized writings out there, speaking to what people think they know about an oral culture, how does that translate? A linear world defining an oral culture. Much is lost in translation, is all I really have to say on that note. But we sit here today and we still have the knowledge, as our ancestors are with us. They're in our blood, in our bones, just like Salilo is in our blood, it's in our bones, genetic markers to who Creator says we are as a people, the clay of the earth that He took to form us as the two-leggeds here, the law that He laid down before us to live by here at Salilo, at the falls. And even when we were cave dwellers on the hillsides before this river even existed, we've been here since the first dawn. We're a five dawn people. Our spiritual ways of being and knowing is beyond the linear world concept or construct of who they say we are. In terms of sovereignty, we've been here since the first dawn. Today I give to a pelican some frozen salmon and steelhead. There is no monetary value in this transaction to feed one of our ancient ones. You see, they were here before us. And that's what we understood as a people. That's what we were governed by, that those things created before us were greater than we, the two-legged.
And again, I spoke with Lana Jack on Wednesday and Thursday of this past week, and here are some of the excerpts from that conversation.
The first thing that a colonial settler would want to do was to disempower our women as even having a voice or a say. In a time when they were getting ready to flood Salila Falls, it was said that these women, my grandmothers, had no right and had no say. Like, they weren't going to inherit nothing here at Salila unless they got married to a man and that man spoke on her behalf. The colonial, I call it toxic masculinity, personally, patriarchal society that would condemn a matriarchal society, just not wanting to acknowledge or value. We carried our women as the voice of our people and as sacred. It's a shame because what boarding schools did, what the institutions of this United States America has done to our families is I'm a woman left here on site at Salila Falls. And yes, I have to fight to stay with the falls and with the bones of my ancestors, my mothers. And it's still a matter of disempowering, disenfranchising, as if though we have no say, as if though we're not even alive. Because there's no man to speak for me here. So I've got to speak out for myself and for my ancestors and for the injustice of flooding our sacred site and killing the river and killing the salmon, and our roots are disappearing, and our huckleberries are being raped in the mountains by rakes. People are just raping the floors of the mountains for the huckleberries. We're at a time when everything's about to go extinct, and it's complete shame because it's all symbiotically interconnected. This matriarch society and the land that we have inhabited for longer than 10,000 years.
I just want to jump in with a quote from Lisa Brunner, who's the executive director of Sacred Spirits First Nations Coalition. They treat Mother Earth like they treat women. They think they can own us, buy us, sell us, trade us, rent us, poison us, rape us, destroy us, use us as entertainment, and kill us. I'm happy to see that we're talking about the level of violence that's occurring against Mother Earth, because it equates to women. What happens to her happens to us. And just want to note really quickly that there is a report in the Atlantic magazine that talked about especially the influx of men to man camps around like the Bakken, around tar sands, you know, wherever these kinds of extraction booms are happening, you get all kinds of predominantly non-native men coming in. In 2012, after the Bakken really got going, the tribal police department reported more murders, fatal accidents, sexual assaults, domestic disputes, drug busts, gun threats, and human trafficking cases than in any other year before. And they saw this similar things in the sort of surrounding areas. And I just want to really clarify that the overwhelming violence against Indigenous women, it's overwhelmingly by non-Native men.
And that poses a problem, especially in Indian country, when Indian courts have no jurisdiction over anybody except their own people. So a non-Native can come onto our land and murder us, and there's no consequences, because we have no jurisdiction over them. The institutions that have been used against us, starting with the military, I mean, they were on Vashon Island, and it was the military that was cutting down these trees to build big ships. Mm-hmm. But it was also, they were the ones who frequented the brothels that our women and children were taken captive to, mm-hmm, back in the 1800s. They don't talk about these things. It's not in the history books. And even when we say it, it makes us some kind of despicable human being, like as if we could conjure this mess in our head. It's our reality. It's our truth. And it hasn't been heard. Now that's at the forefront of many conversations.
You've been listening to a conversation with Celila YM activist Lana Jack. Again, May 5th is Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women's Day. So if you are not already organizing something for that date, you've still got some lead time to do that. And again, this Wednesday, March 10th, is the 64th anniversary of the inundation of Celila Falls. This has been Desiree Hillers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m., and I want to thank our contributors and guests and editors for making today's show possible: Bill Resnick, Susanna Kasouf, Jan Hawken, Diana Meisenhelter, Johanna Brenner, Adam Obenauer, Desiree Helgers, and Lana Jack. Patricia Kohlberg, John Nelson, Desiree Helgers, and myself, your host this morning, Denise Morris, had a hand in editing this program. It takes a labor. I want to remind you, this week, March 8th through 14th, has been designated as a National Week of Action to Stop the Line 3 Pipeline Project. For a list of daily online solidarity actions, you can go to How I Love the Earth. Today, Monday, March 8th at 11:30 a.m., join the Pipeline Apocalypse. Folks will be meeting at Fields Park in Northwest Portland. And again, for more information on these and other events for the week of March 8th through 14th, visit How I Love the Earth. We'll have all of this information up on the website in the next couple of days. With that, a reminder that you can find The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, and tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.